Middle age brings some rather disturbing questions. We're all familiar with the idea of a midlife crisis. And part of mine, I guess, has sort of taken the form of struggling with the social ideals of my youth. In the 19th, I was one of a person who went to college in the 1960s and was active in some of the movement then, the civil rights movement, the peace movement, in very mild kinds of ways. And my own denomination, the Southern Baptist, are now locked in a struggle very similar to that split the Missouri Synod Lutherans several years ago. And now it's almost certain that the fundamentalists have won. They have control of just about all of our boards and agencies, and they will not permit anybody who they will not allow any ordained woman, for example, to participate in any kind of activity. And so some of what I'm going to say sort of grows out of this kind of personal struggles of the last several years. Let me just ask you, when you hear the name Rhino Niebuhr, does that ring any bells for you? Now, those of you that have been to seminary, probably you had to read some of Niebuhr, but what about those of you who are lay people? Does the name Rhino Niebuhr, some people are kind of nodding, what does it conjure up for you when you hear Rhino Niebuhr? What does the name, does it just kind of, you faintly recognize it, or does it produce some kind of image? Okay, well, let me tell you just a little bit about Niebuhr. Any chance I get when I can talk about Niebuhr, I'll do it. I suppose more than any other single modern thinker, Niebuhr has had a great influence on me. Niebuhr was born in the Midwest in 1892, was the son of a first-generation German immigrant pastor in the evangelical church that later became the Evangelical and Reformed, and today is the United Church of Christ after the merger in 1957 with the Congregational churches in New England. Niebuhr went to Elmhurst College. He graduated from Eden Seminary in St. Louis, which at that time was an unaccredited seminary. And he had the audacity to go on to Yale. And he wrote to his parents that when he got to Yale, he felt like he was a mongrel among thoroughbreds. And in fact, during his first year, he went in to talk to the dean about pursuing not simply a master's program, but a doctorate, and the dean laughed at him. And so Niebuhr never got an earned doctorate, probably one of the three or four greatest theological minds in American history. And incidentally, that dean was shortly thereafter shipped out somewhere else, and Niebuhr would have been accepted into the program. But by this time, he had decided to serve as a pastor in Detroit. And he got there in 1915, which was the year after Henry Ford introduced the assembly line and the Model T. And so for 12 years, Niebuhr was the pastor of a little church there in Detroit that grew fairly substantially while he was there. I think it had about 600 members when he left. And during this time, he had some of his congregation worked in the Ford plant, and Henry Ford enjoyed the reputation of being a great philanthropist and treating his workers very well, But Niebuhr knew that there was another side to the story. And so he found himself locked in some struggles with Henry Ford, and published several articles about Ford. And Ford tried to use what influence he had to force a retraction. But Niebuhr's congregation stood behind him, and Niebuhr basically said, look, if you'll show me that I'm wrong, I'll take it back. And the Ford people never could show that Niebuhr was wrong. He wrote about these years in Detroit, in which he also struggled with the issue of the outcome of World War I. He was very much in favor of the war. In fact, did a lot as a German descendant to get the support of German Americans for that war, but was disillusioned with what happened after the war, and began to rethink the whole idea of the Christian ethic on war. And it was after the war that you had a great influx of black people from the South into the North. And so Niebuhr confronted the race issue there in the early 20s. He wrote about this in a book that's really a diary called Leaves from the Notebook of a Tamed Cynic. That is marvelous reading. And anybody, I think, who is a pastor or a pastor's wife ought to read that book. And it's good for lay people, too. It's not hard to read. I mean, it's the reflections of a pastor simply on his daily work. Well, by 1927, Niebuhr had gained significant national and international recognition and was invited to become professor of Christian ethics at Union Seminary in New York. The faculty was very much opposed to his coming, but the president of Union had a kind of astute, intuitive sense of what Niebuhr could do. And of course, Niebuhr is the one who really, probably more than any other person, with the possible exception of Paul Tillich, made Union Seminary the theological seminary in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s. In the bookstore, I noticed that the bookstore has copies of two of Niebuhr's books. They're really, one of them has two volumes. But in 1932, Niebuhr gained, his reputation went up, both positively and negatively, depending on how you look at it, when he wrote a book called Moral Man and Immoral Society. He later said, with his tongue in his cheek, that maybe I should have named that Immoral Man and Even Less Moral Society. But you need to recall what's going on here in the late 20s and the 30s with the labor movement fighting for recognition. The socialist movement is quite strong, and Niebuhr was very active in the Socialist Party in the late 20s and early 30s. I suppose his most famous book was the one that is called The Nature and Destiny of Man, that was the culmination of his Gifford Lectures. The Gifford Lectures are invited lectures at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and these are among the most prestigious theological lectures around. And Niebuhr gave those in 1939, and then the book was published, the first volume, I think, in 41, and the second volume in 43. And he continued a horrendous schedule of speaking and writing that lasted until he suffered a stroke in the early 1950s. And he continued to teach, although he never had the kind of energy after that he had before. There's a real debate about whether there was some significant decline in his intellectual powers after the stroke. But now let me, so that's a little something about Niebuhr. Now, I'm going to lecture a little bit more today than I have the last couple of times, but I'm pretty sure we'll have some time at the end to reflect. So I hope this will be provocative and controversial, and stir your passions and your thoughts. How is it possible to sustain a passion for social justice in the midst of such intransigent forces that protect the status quo? How is it possible to affirm the ambiguities of life without surrendering entirely the idealistic visions of youth? How is it possible to work sanely for social and economic justice, knowing that such activity can never bring in the perfect kingdom of God? I think Reinhold Niebuhr may give us some clues about how to live with ambiguity and at the same time maintain passion for justice. Near the end of his pastorate in Detroit in 1920, which stretched from 1915 to really to early 1928, Niebuhr faced the problem of whether civilization needed religion at all. The Christian church, he thought, was simply ineffective in bringing about significant social change. Didn't really help much whether you converted individuals or whether you educated them, because neither one of those brought real change. He wrote a book called Does Civilization Need Religion? And he said religion, especially the teachings of Jesus, had some resources for bringing about constructive social change. But Niebuhr noted that the high spiritual values of the Sermon on the Mount had real limitations when you tried to force those into some kind of social public policy. He asked the question, will turning the other cheek deal effectively with Henry Ford's exploitation of his workers? Will appeals to goodwill and brotherhood alter the segregations of blacks and whites in the South? He began to say that Christianity possesses what he called a vital idealism. He believed that Christianity had a kind of passion for justice. In other words, Christianity sensitized people and made them want to do something about the problems they saw. The problem was Christianity seemed to be too idealistic. It lacked what he called astute intelligence. In other words, it didn't know quite what to do with these problems of war, and racism, and some of the new exploitation that took place on the assembly line. So it was at this time that Niebuhr began to flirt with Marxism. And in the book, Moral Man and Immoral Society, what Niebuhr proposed in that book was what he called a frank dualism of morals. He said, let's just be honest and take the Sermon on the Mount and say that applies only to relationships within families and between individual persons. But when we start dealing with these big social issues, we've got to be more realistic and we've got to fight power with power. And so he says, look, we've just got to, we've got to compromise on Jesus' teachings and maybe Marxism can give us the kind of astute intelligence we need to make the changes that the gospel tells us need to be made. Now, within a couple of years, Niebuhr's ready to take that back. And the reason he wanted to take it back was that he came to believe that Marxism was not simply astute intelligence, that Marxism was itself a kind of religion. And so he wrote a piece about 1934 on Marxism as religion. And he talked about Marxism being not simply an a critical, unbiased analysis of what's going on in society. But Marxism is a kind of fanaticism that absolutizes or idolizes certain values and totally condemns others. In other words, Marxism tended to see the world almost entirely in terms of good and evil, black and white. And so the institution of private property, for example, you know, came under absolute criticism. And various kinds of socialist forms of society were kind of lifted up as absolutely good. Now, what he saw happening with Marxism was that Marxism was too sure of itself, too certain of its truth that human beings can seize control of history and bring in the kingdom of freedom. Marxism, therefore, had no qualms about using whatever means necessary to reach its desired ends. Fanaticism, in other words, is a religious problem because fanaticism involves idolatry. It's worshiping something that's not God. So at the end of this essay, Niebuhr said, "It is therefore only the high religion which worships a holy God before whom all people feel themselves sinners that can maintain the elements of decency, pity, and forgiveness in human life and can resist the cruelty and inhumanity which flow inevitably from the process that absolutizes some human values and identifies others with the very source of all evil." Now, Niebuhr said there's a warning here for us as well, because the problem of political idolatry is not something that belongs only to communism. And Niebuhr, the holiday that Niebuhr least felt comfortable celebrating in his church was Thanksgiving. Because Niebuhr says that in America, Thanksgiving becomes a kind of self-congratulation, and that we get God all mixed up with Uncle Sam. And that he pointed out some of the prayers that you typically hear at Thanksgiving services. You know, "God, we thank you that we're not like all these other people." And so you kind of absolutize a certain way of life. Now, notice here how the problem of a viable social ethic has shifted. At first, Niebuhr thought that religion basically gave one a passion for justice. And the problem was how to discipline that and guide it. Tell it what to do. Now, the problem is, how can we have a social ethic that avoids fanaticism on the one hand and despair or moral inertia, as he liked to say, on the other? He was very fond of the image of Shiloh and Charybdis, the rock and the whirlpool. I mean, kind of, you know, steering a course that avoids both fanaticism on the one hand and moral inertia on the other. So, about the middle 30s, this is kind of where he is. Now, the whole problem here is exacerbated, made more difficult, by Niebuhr's increasing realization that life and history are permanently saturated with ambiguities. And I think this is one thing that kind of happens in middle age. Religion is ambiguous. Religion is just as often a force for evil as it is for good. Reason is ambiguous. Sometimes reason is an impartial guide to truth, but sometimes reason is used perversely to justify our own selfish ends. Technology is ambiguous. Technology offers incredible possibilities for addressing problems of hunger and disease. but technology can also destroy us. Freedom is ambiguous. Freedom can be the occasion for noble achievements, but also for heinous crimes. How then is it possible to work sanely for a better world? How is it possible to maintain moral vigor in the face of permanent ambiguity? Wouldn't we be better off to simply ignore the ambiguities and substitute a utopian vision? Niebuhr flirted for a time with what he called necessary illusions, just like Eugene O'Neill did. Wouldn't we be better off maybe to simply abandon the world altogether and retreat permanently to Holden Village and live happily ever after? How do we live with permanent ambiguity and the moral and spiritual uncertainty that inevitably accompanies it? Especially in this day when everybody seems to demand and get simplistic answers. Now, it was just at this point that Niebuhr began writing about myth. Now, what he means by myth here is basically a story that sort of underlies our sense of who we are and gives meaning and purpose and direction to everything that we do. And so, it was myth instead of pure reason that began to attract Niebuhr. Myth is often hidden from us, for it involves the most fundamental assumptions of our existence. Who am I? What am I here for? And we simply grow up, and this is simply a part of the atmosphere. And so what Niebuhr wanted to do was to look more closely at the Christian myth or the Christian story and probe it for what it can tell us about the meaning and purpose of life, particularly as it relates to ambiguity. Now, the word ambiguity basically means that something can have more than one interpretation. It's ambiguous. And you first look at it, and you're not quite sure. So, Niebuhr's whole theological program can be seen as an attempt to reinterpret the Christian story for our time. Now, moving here to number three, the cross and social ethics. Niebuhr sort of saw that the focal image, the most important symbol, of course, is the cross. And so Niebuhr's social ethics is built around an interpretation of the cross, crucifixion, and what this means. Before I get into that, I want to do a little aside here, because Niebuhr has a charming little essay on humor and faith. And he points out in there how ambiguity creates the possibility of humor. After all, what is humor but something that, because it's ambiguous, enables something to break our pattern of expectation? Recently, one of my colleagues in the English department at Furman gave a lecture on the joys of ambiguity, and he gave an illustration that illustrates perfectly what Niebuhr is talking about. He is a specialist in 18th century British literature, particularly Thomas Sterne's, and so this little example comes from Tristram Shandy. And it seems that there's a very well-decorated war hero, Uncle Toby, who was wounded in one of the battles that he fought, and he was wounded in the groin. And as he retires, he lives next door to a very proper widow, Widow Wadman. And she is very curious about this wound. And for years, she makes very discreet inquiries about it. And finally, one day, she just can't stand it any longer. She said, "Well, now tell me, sir, you know, exactly where was it that you were wounded? And he said, Madam, you shall see the very place. You shall put your finger on the very spot. And he stood up and he unrolled his battlefield maps. The point is, it's the ambiguity of place there. And breaking the pattern of expectations, see, that creates the humor in that. And, but Niebuhr has a marvelous little essay that's recently been republished called Humor in Faith. And he talks about how, you know, ambiguity makes humor possible, and that humor is a way of dealing with some of the ambiguities of life. But there are ambiguities that only faith can take care of, that only faith can respond to. Now, the cross, when Niebuhr talks about the cross, he speaks of it in three ways. That the cross reveals God's nature as sacrificial love. The cross points to the possibilities of a new beginning. This, of course, is the looking at the cross from the point of view of the resurrection. And then the cross is an ethical truth. It's a norm. It's a criteria by which we can understand ourselves and make judgments in history. Now, the cross itself is ambiguous. Paul knew that. In 1 Corinthians, for example, he writes, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to those of us who are being saved, it is the power of God." From a strictly historical point of view, the cross is little more than the tragic death of a noble idealist, or if the Romans were right, simply a revolutionary. But in the context of the Christian story, faith perceives that the suffering of Jesus on the cross is the suffering of God. And if that be true, then the cross becomes a revelation of God's nature as sacrificial love, self-giving love. The word agape sort of describes that. In other words, the cross is a kind of window through which we get a glimpse of the suffering love of God, which points both to God's mercy and to the possibilities of a new beginning. But faith can't obscure or deny the fact that the cross has a tragic dimension to it. There's a sense in which God is powerless within history. Love, sacrificial love, is not a power that gradually overcomes all of the ambiguities of history and triumphs over evil in some kind of utopian society. This is the way Niebuhr says it. The final majesty, the ultimate freedom, and the perfect disinterestedness of God's love can have a counterpart in history only in a life that ends tragically, because God's love refuses to participate in the claims and counterclaims of historical existence. In other words, God's love is radically impartial. Now think about the implications of that. They're kind of disturbing. It means that we, like Job, must learn to serve God for naught. Without asking, what's in this religion for me? It means the death of the capricious, omnipotent God who can be manipulated for selfish ends. And it means the end of our lobbying in the courts of the Almighty for special favors that come at the expense of others. I played high school football. And we prayed before every game. Niebuhr notes that Jesus chooses the impartiality of nature in the Sermon on the Mount to symbolize the impartiality of God's love. Rain falls on the just and the unjust. So Jesus is not a Rambo type who slaughters the enemies of God-fearing Americans. And neither is he a fairy godfather who pulls the strings for his favorite football team or his preferred candidate for Miss America. Although so many Miss Americas think they have been divinely chosen. Rather, Jesus is the suffering servant who reveals the impartial, self-giving love of God and thereby undermines every pretentious claim that God is on my side. It's simply not true that history conforms to justice. Rain falls on the just and the unjust. The cross, therefore, engenders a contrite spirit and restrains the impulse to fanaticism. Remember the problem, we've got to steer clear of fanaticism. We've got to stay away from the rock. Now, how are we going to avoid falling into inertia? Well, one of Niebuhr's paradoxes, he says, history is not ultimately tragic. For the cross, from the point of view of the resurrection, symbolizes a new beginning. The powerlessness of God within history reflects the power of God's freedom over the structures of history. The cross generates hope, an umbrella of meaning that enables the person of faith to live in the midst of moral ambiguity and to accept responsibility for the problems of everyday life, having and caring for children, seeking peace between races and nations, or working for a more just economic order. Hope, therefore, characterizes faith's relation to the problems of everyday life. Why? Niebuhr says such projects, like having and caring for children and working for peace and justice, are meaningful not because we are guaranteed of success, but because the divine power which bears history can complete what even the highest human striving must leave incomplete. And it can purify the corruptions which appear in even the purest human aspirations. In other words, the gospel basically says that God bears the ultimate responsibility for how history is going to turn out. We're freed from the burden of having to succeed. It's God who's Alpha and Omega, not us. We're not commanded to accomplish anything. We're not commanded to be successful. We are, says Niebuhr, called to be faithful. Finally, for Niebuhr, the cross is an ethical truth. He refers to it as that impossible possibility that defines the ultimate standards by which we ought to live. In one sense, what does he mean by this term, impossible possibility? One of the difficulties of reading Niebuhr is that he will entangle you in these paradoxes. And sometimes you wonder, you know, either this is really gobbledygook or this is profound truth.
Probably both.
That's probably right. Impossible possibilities. Now, what in the world would he say something like that? What he means is that there's a sense in which we're never able to act purely sacrificially. But if we weren't able, if our capacity to love were not at least partially determined by that, we would never even get started with loving. And, you know, in terms of kind of cost and benefit, I'm only going to do those things that are going to come back to me in some kind of benefit or reward. So, you know, you have a friendship, which Niebuhr refers to as mutual love. It's a kind of love in which both people benefit. But Niebuhr would say that mutual love would never even get started if there weren't a little bit of agape there. Because in order for mutual love to get started, somebody's got to take a risk. One of the risks of loving is that that love might not be returned. And that hurts. And so, the agape is this impossible possibility. Thus, agape is not totally powerless, because it is able to create and sustain mutual love and the passion for justice. And it's not totally impossible, for there's a measure of agape in all acts of love and in all attempts to do justly. Thus, for Niebuhr, justice now re-enters the picture. Remember the first thing we talked about, justice was transcended by the impartial, self-giving love of God. We have to serve God for naught. But now justice comes back as a human vocation. Not a description of what it is, but as a calling or a task for we who are created in the image of God. God's impartial, self-giving love renders God powerless within history. God is vulnerable, dependent upon human beings created in the image of God and called to represent God in the world. There are echoes here of the second commandment that I talked about on Tuesday night, I think. The commandment, you shall have no graven images. Walter Harrelson, in his book, The Ten Commandments and Human Rights, asserts that the main reason for the prohibition of graven images lay in the fact that the community of Israel itself was called to be the image of God in the world, and the worship of graven images would stifle the community's sense of vocation, its responsibility to represent God in the world. Now, talking about love here, taking a risk, to kind of move on in Niebuhr's analysis. Niebuhr says that the example of sacrificial love, love that asks nothing in return, it is that kind of love that really breaks down our walls of apathy and generates moral vigor. For love empowers us to accept the risk of suffering that inevitably accompany deeds of love. Now, we don't like to talk about suffering, and I don't want to suggest that Christianity is masochistic. You know, sometimes you get the idea that the point of Christianity is to accumulate so many units of pain, and that these will be cashed in at the gate of heaven and you'll be rewarded, kind of in terms of what you have suffered. But I think Dorothy Zerla is right that in the kind of world we live in, love often, if not always, ends up on a cross. Love, in other words, always entails the risk of suffering. And the cross is a kind of window through which we get a glimpse of the suffering that even God undergoes in loving the world. One of the chief rivals to Christianity in the ancient world was Stoicism. And for Stoicism, the ideal description of salvation was apathy or contentment. And the Stoic reasoned something like this, that if I try to change the world, I end up being frustrated. And so the classic Stoic prayer was one given by Epictetus that went, "Ask not that things should happen as you will, but let your will be that things should happen as they do, and you will have peace." Now, he went on to illustrate this very graphically. He said, don't get attached to your beer mug, because then if you break it, you'll be disappointed. And when you kiss your wife or your child, say to yourself, this is just a woman and a little boy. And then if death strikes them, you will not know the pain of grief. Now, Christianity basically said that the cost of Stoic apathy is the surrender of love itself. If one is not able or is unwilling to suffer, then one is unable to love. Whenever then, it's faith born of the cross that serves to anchor a social ethic that steers between the Shiloh of moral fanaticism and the Charybdis of moral inertia. The impartial, self-giving love of God engenders a contrite spirit, a sense of humility, and thus restrains the pretension, the arrogance, that might nourish fanaticism. But as the impossible possibility that serves as the ultimate ethical standard of history, such love breaks down our walls of apathy and generates moral vigor. The cross, in other words, gives us responsibility, but at the same time, it keeps us under criticism. The cross empowers us for unending struggle, but it prepares us for perennial disappointment. It compels us to do good, but it warns us of the inevitable evil in the course of doing good. I had a little trouble about how I should end this, and finally decided that maybe an appropriate ending would be simply to quote Micah 6:8, which was one of Niebuhr's favorite scripture passages. What does God require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. Let me see what your reaction is. Gobbledygook. Barry?
Response to liberation theology and its claim that God is partial, that there is a preferential option for the poor and the oppressed, and that God really does in history take sides.
Okay. One of the interesting things about Niebuhr and a project that I'm currently working on, Niebuhr is claimed for support both by some liberation theologians and by those who are so adamantly opposed to liberation theology. And so there must be some ambiguity in Niebuhr that enables him to be claimed by both sides, and I am trying to discover exactly what that is. Let me kind of respond to this. I think at a theoretical kind of level, I think Niebuhr would have some difficulty with liberation theology at that point. See, what Niebuhr does, Niebuhr wants to say that history really has two sets of problems. You have your ultimate problems, and then what he calls the penultimate, which basically means not quite ultimate. Now, the problem of justice is, for Niebuhr, a kind of penultimate problem. And the reason he doesn't see it as the ultimate problem is that because all of us are sinners. And therefore, if you're going to talk about justice, you can't simply talk about it in terms of when the righteous are going to be exalted and the wicked are going to be punished. In other words, if all of us are sinners, and if everything we do, no matter how noble, is tainted in some way, then unless we have an answer to the ultimate problem, which is the sinfulness of all of us, then we really can't talk about justice. And so what Niebuhr would want to say, that in a kind of practical sense, yes, there is a critical partiality with the poor and the oppressed, but that needs to stand under the more unconditional claim that God's love is impartial. And I think some liberation theologians would be comfortable with a kind of qualification like that, that it's not that God loves the poor more, but that this is in fact the best means for saving both the rich and the poor, in a way. So in a theoretical sense, I think there would be some real differences between Niebuhr and liberation theology. In a practical sense, I think that probably Niebuhr would not have that great a problem. I don't know if that's a good answer.
Satisfied. For now.
Yeah.
Dan? If God in Christ is accepting the way of sacrifice on the cross and emptying himself to that, how is that powerlessness?
Okay, well, I think what Niebuhr, when he talks about powerlessness, he's speaking of it there specifically in terms of overcoming the kind of ambiguities that we find ourselves in history. See, Niebuhr is reacting to a view of history that because Christ has come, the world is gradually getting better. And what Niebuhr saw was that at every stage of history, we have choices for good and evil. And that when Niebuhr, for example, talked about the various kinds of images of the end time, he talked about the image of the Antichrist, which, you know, for him sort of meant that at no point did history reach a place where evil was not a very real possibility. And so that's the sense in which it's powerless, that it does not, in our experience, remove I'm looking for another word here than simply ambiguity again. And Niebuhr was very fond of the kind of thought that we are simultaneously saved and sinners. I mean, you know, we're kind of both at the same time. How would you, you want to take that further?
The way you said it, that the cross is symbolic of powerlessness.
Powerlessness within history. But the flip side of that that it reflects a kind of power over
love.
Right, power, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's an expression of the power of love. It's, okay, you're talking about powerlessness in history to help the world get better and better.
Or to remove forever the possibility that there would be evil. Okay. I mean,
let's maybe put that in terms of the individual then also. We're both sinner and saint, but is there a process of spiritual growth or transformation that is available to a Christian, or is one always
I think that this may be a real deficiency in Niebuhr. And on Tuesday night, I talked about ethics as the formation of character, and which over the last several years, I have been reading people like John Howard Yoder and Stanley Hauerwas, you know, for whom this kind of process of sanctification, of growth, is indeed a possibility and a reality. And to be quite honest, I'm not quite sure yet how to integrate that into my own thought that has been so heavily influenced by somebody like Niebuhr. So I think you may have hit on something here, that there may be a problem with Niebuhr. Valerie?
Well, I think one of the things that Niebuhr is trying to argue is that history is creative but not redemptive.
Okay,
and
that's a good way to put it.
Well, unlike somebody like Yoder, who says what Christians really ought to do is imitate Jesus, Niebuhr says, well, that's not really quite right because we're finite and we don't have really the option to be totally self-sacrificing. That was appropriate for Jesus as God on earth, but not really appropriate for us. We're finite and sinful. So we can't really abrogate our responsibility to work for justice. Because even if you can't be perfectly loving or have a world where violence disappears, you can be smart and pit power against power and achieve justice that's better than what you would have had if you hadn't tried to do that, or better than what you would have had if you had just been utopian and said, well, let's just all love each other or not have war anymore or whatever. Niebuhr was really, I think, disillusioned by World War II and what that did to pacifism. He felt that it really showed that pacifism was bankrupt because it wouldn't pit power against power. So I think Niebuhr thought the cross was very powerful, but not really an option for us to choose. Maybe sometimes, on some occasions, but mainly he thought we should just do the dirty work of being responsible. And for him that meant justice. Because love really isn't available to societies. Nations don't really love each other, and we live in groups. You know, we don't just function as individuals. So that's why the cross is an impossible possibility. There's no limit to justice. History is endlessly creative, but it never transforms itself into the kingdom. So you have to, that's why it's ambiguous.
That is a marvelous statement. I want to get a transcript of that from the tape. So that was very nicely put. Very nicely put. Niebuhr defines justice as the realization of love under the conditions of history. That's right. And he.
Right now, Matthew Fox is a very popular theologian of original blessings.
I have not read the book. Several people have mentioned that name to me.
But he's emphasizing the first article in creation, and many young college students today, and particularly women, respond very positively to his theology. All the time I heard him speak, I felt very uncomfortable because I want to say what would Niebuhr respond is, but it's a very upbeat theology of saying, that this vision of the world is just too bleak, and we've got to flip that over, and we've got to have a more positive affirmation of creativity and life and original blessing, other than other original ways we got them. I'm still very uncomfortable with, but I'm still saying, how come so many other people are finding him so exciting, and particularly, he's saying something that they are really into.
I'll have to get on with it. I think I just heard the bell, and thank you for your patience. And,